We're in the studio right now with the guy who calls himself Chucky V, right? Chuck Vasganian?
Chuck Vasganian, yeah.
You have this project or this business. What is this, Rockmon?
Rockmon Record Club. It's actually Labor of Love is what it is. I hesitate to call it a business because that means it's work. and this is not work for me. This is so much fun. I delve into an album that I love and I spend month and a half with it. And then I get up and talk about it with people and listen to the record with a whole bunch of people. It's very cool.
You're about to do one with the folks at the Linda with The Who.
Yes, with The Who.
We're going to get to that in just a moment, but first I wanted to talk to you a little bit about Rockmon. How long ago did you start doing this?
I started doing it in earnest about 2.5 years ago. My wife is a college professor, and she got a scholarship to teach over in Europe. So we went to Hungary. She was teaching during the week. Part of the deal with this was the job that I'd had for 20 years that I really didn't like very much anymore. I had lost the love of it. I have a sound business and I was doing my sound business. And my wife said to me, why don't you just quit your job and come to Europe with me? Of course, my father, who has been gone for about 15 years, his voice came through loud and clear in my head and said, oh, you're going to quit your job and you're going to be unemployed. So it took me a while to get to the idea that I would quit my job, but I did. I retired is what I call it. I didn't quit. I retired. I went to Europe with her after we sold the house. So that means by my father's standard, I was homeless. And I sold my car, which meant I didn't even have a car so I could go to work. I had done everything my father would never have wanted me to do. I did. Karen's working during the week. I was engaged with the area. I was talking to people. I was having fun. And I thought to myself, I should do a podcast while I'm over here. I said, I'm going to write a podcast. And I was listening to podcasts. I was listening to a lot of podcasts from America. This can't be that hard. So what am I going to do it about? I'm going to do it about music. So I started with David Bowie, Young Americans, was the first album that I did. And I wrote it all out, and I took all the music, and I did edits, and I tried to do it sort of like a radio show. And I had a little Tascam two-channel recorder, and I recorded it with that. And I started writing more. I did Led Zeppelin, I did a Beatles album, and I didn't publish any of them. I didn't do anything with them. I just wrote them and recorded them. I don't know. I got home and I started thinking about what I was going to do with it. I had these things and I had continued to keep writing them. I had maybe 6 or 7 of them written at this point.
Well, I wanted to ask, did you have to do a lot of research or did you know a lot of the stuff already?
Sort of 50-50. I knew a lot of the stuff already. And I guess I really should go back a little bit into the story. My mom and dad were both opera singers, classically trained opera singers. They both went to Manhattan School of Music. My mother, more than my father, taught me how to listen to music. We would sit down with classical albums and she'd teach me what all the different instruments in the orchestra sounded like and that whole like sort of Peter and the Wolf way that you bring kids into music. I've always had a love of music and my mom and I used to spend hours listening to music and talking about albums and talking about music. And I was just really engaged. I played percussion, which was something that my parents didn't necessarily understand being opera singers. Why would you want to hit a drum when you can sing or play a real instrument? I loved percussion because in my mind that flits from thing to thing to thing, in one piece of music, I could play 5 or 6 different instruments. Plus, you stand up. The only other person that stands up in the entire band is the conductor and his back is to the audience. I get to stand up and look at the audience. So they know who, you know, it's an ego thing for a young kid. And I loved it. And I had rock bands and things like that. And my friends and I, a lot of what we did socially was sit around and listen to music and pass around the album cover and other substances and listen to music and talk about music and turn each other on to different music that we were listening to. I spent a lot of time when I was a kid listening to the radio. So doing this Rockmon idea, and it didn't start off as Rockmon. I had a bunch of different names for it. I asked my son, Mateo, I said, I can't figure out a name for this podcast thing I'm doing. And he says, oh, Rockmon. It was a name that I had used years ago. Rockmon Record Club. It just sort of made sense to me, and it had this other connection to my family, so it was cool. Yeah. I got home, and I had these things. I had gotten an association with the Universal Preservation Hall. I started doing some work for them. And Teddy Foster and Mary Beth McGarahan, who run the Universal Preservation Hall, I was over there one day, and I said, hey, Teddy, would you mind if some Tuesday night I just did a show here and played a movie and talked about the music and stuff? Nope, not at all. Whatever you want to do. Great. So I did Joe Cocker's Mad Dogs and Englishmen, which is a great movie. I said, do you mind if I do another one next month? And no, go ahead. So I started doing the third Tuesday of every month. I did David Bowie was the next one, Young Americans. And I just kept doing different shows. It was great. It was really starting to build. I think we got up to 35 people. Teddy brought me over to Cafe Lena, introduced me to Sarah, We talked about some things. Sarah said, love to have you. So I started doing shows there. What I try to do is sort of recreate that feeling that we had the first time we were listening to the album and what it means to listen to an album, that we don't listen to just the songs that we like. We don't create a playlist. The playlist is you play side one and then you play side two. That's the playlist. There's nothing else to do with it but that.
Now, we're here with Chuck Mazganian. We're going to have you at the Linda on the 27th of December.
Yes, we just started doing shows at the Linda, and this will be our third one. That's a great room. It's a great room to do it in. Carl Blackwood, who runs the Linda, is a great friend. They do a great job there.
Let's start talking a little bit about Who's Next. So that's
sure,
the record you're going to be talking about, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Why did you choose Who's Next, I guess would be the first question.
Well, you know, for me, I love concept albums. I really fought liking The Who. A good friend of mine growing up really liked The Who. And we used to argue a lot about, you know, I was a Grand Funk Railroad guy. You know, I compare Grand Funk Railroad to The Who. But I was a Grand Funk Railroad guy, and I liked Black Sabbath, and I loved Led Zeppelin. And I wasn't really, like, The Who didn't really grab me. Then Tommy came out, and it was like, wow, this is epic and different. And it took me to my classical, this is sort of my mom's thing, you know, it was an opera, right? So it had all the elements of opera, and I understood it had all the elements of opera in it. With just listening to it, I knew. My mom and I used to listen to Tommy together. But Who's Next? Man, when that album came out, you put that album on, and Bob O'Reilly it slays you. It was so different than anything that we'd heard before. At least that's what it struck me as at the time. Just so different and so new and so fresh. And it had this electronic music, which we knew it was headed that way. We were hearing electronic music. We had been hearing some of it for years anyway. Everybody was doing little things in their albums using synthesizers, and we understood what synthesizers were. It was just really cool. I choose albums based on what I like. I have to really feel a connection to the record. And this is one of those, and there's so many records. I have over 3,500 albums at home, so I have a lot to choose from. Yeah, yeah.
Now let's listen to a song, but we're not going to hear something from Who's Next.
No,
right?
This is Pure and Easy, and Pure and Easy shows up on the album Odds and Sods. It's the first time it's actually on a Who record. Pete Townsend's always talked about Pure and Easy being the heart of the Lifehouse album, and Lifehouse never really fully came to fruition in Townsend's vision. And I go into this a fair amount in the show. I talk about Lifehouse and how everything originated. There's a lot of songs.
That was to be the follow-up to Tommy.
That was to be, exactly. That was to be the follow-up to Tommy. And Townsend went down a rabbit hole, man. He could not. He was obsessing. He was doing things. He was making it much more complicated than it needed to be. And all the band wanted to do was record an album and get back out on the road. They wanted a tour. They wanted to play. That's where they were alive, all of them. Townsend was the guy that was writing all the music and writing a majority of the words. I mean, Entwistle would write something every once in a while, but for the most part, it was all Townsend. So he was engaged all the time, but the band was only really engaged when they were recording or when they were out on the road. This writing stuff and arranging stuff, that wasn't their deal. So they were bored. They wanted to get going. Townsend came in with Lifehouse. He wanted to do live performances, and he wanted to create this one note that would be this nirvanic thing where everyone would be transported to a different plane of existence.
It was the time, wasn't it?
It was the time, exactly. You were either going to do it with something you were putting in your body, or you were going to do it with a note. He was in pretty much a deep thing with Meher Baba, his spiritual guide. Townsend had really changed his life. He had gotten off of drugs and alcohol. He had stopped doing that stuff, which, you know, is a big life-changing event for people who have stopped abusing themselves with drugs and alcohol. I personally have. I'm an alcoholic in recovery, long-term recovery. I've been sober for a long time. I don't mind talking about that because this is part of my story. So I can identify with this part. And I don't spend a lot of time on drugs and alcohol in my stories about bands because every band has them, and that's what it is. Townsend has changed his life at this point, and he's looking for a way to express that. A lot of the songs on Who's Next and a lot of the songs that came from Lifehouse are about that spiritual quest. About wanting to a bargain. You know, I gladly trade anything to be at that next level of existence. I trade everything to be there. It would be a bargain. Now, we think that's about a woman, but it's not. It's about a spiritual existence, and that's where Townsend was at the time. He is going full bore at writing this Lifehouse thing, and the band is like, no. They just didn't want to do it. So they culled out songs, and they pulled things out. They did a lot of demos. There was a lot of demoing. So they had these nice frameworks to work within, and they chose about 15 songs that they were going to really work on. And Pure and Easy was one of them. Townsend has said over and over again that this is the core of, this is the very seed that Lifehouse sprang from. It defines the whole album, and by because of that, it defines who's next. I listen and I heard music in a world.
So that's Pure and Easy, The Who, on WEXT. I'm with Chuck Mazganian. Thank you so much, Chuck, for coming by.
Oh, thank you, Chris.
This is the guy that does the Rockmon Record Club listening parties, and you've got a listening party at the Linda on the 27th. You'll be listening to Who's Next. Now,
Who's Next?
Pure and Easy, of course, not on Who's Next. How do we go from Pure and Easy into the album that you're going to be doing?
We're set up with the idea that Pure and Easy is the heart of the album. We listen to the song before I get into playing Who's Next. The very first thing that I do is do the liner notes. So the first thing I do is introduce the band and who plays what. We talk about the studio, where it was recorded, if there were any special players. It happens that on Who's Next, one of the things that they did is they were at the record plant in New York City and they had Leslie West doing some demos. So Leslie West is part of Who's Next, even though he isn't on Who's Next. Mm-hmm. He recorded a lot of the demo guitar parts. And then we get into a bit of the backstory of the band. The breakdown is what I call it. And it's the backstory of the band. In this case, I give some historical perspective in that Who's Next comes between Tommy and Quadrophenia. It's got a lot of work to do to have the kind of credibility that it has sitting between those two records. I talk about that, and then we get into the album. Then we start playing the songs. And before I play each song, I talk about the song and anything unique and interesting, any stories that I've heard about it. Sometimes the meaning of the lyrics, although I stay away from lyrics usually an in-depth thing because it feels like a cheap grab for me to talk about the meaning of words. Specifically, if an artist has said something, like Townsend has said about his spiritual quest. If I can find that thread through the songs, I'll talk about that. But one of the things that I do is use some audio clips and ideas and things that are examples of some of the things that I'm talking about. Specifically, of things for people to hear that they haven't heard before, or things that they've heard and didn't know what they were. Those kind of things, little things like that can illustrate the point.
Let's actually illustrate some of the points that you might be making on the Who's Next record. You sent over some songs you thought we might dip into a little bit. East of Eden, one of the bands that you sent over.
Terry Riley, we should talk about a little bit. Terry Riley was still alive, and he's still making music. He considers himself a jazz guy, but he was really one of the pioneers of electronic music. And he does this stuff that we would probably call today trance music. We have to remember that in the late 50s and early 60s, and actually going up into the 70s, synthesizers were monophonic. They could only produce one note at a time. You couldn't play a chord. So in order to do that, they had to be able to use all three tracks of their three-track reel-to-reel machines and overdub and bounce tracks and do a lot of other things to create chords and to create this atmosphere. And Riley was really into this, and he recorded a lot of these sort of tone poem kind of ideas, a lot of shifting sounds, things that he would play a note and then he'd modulate the envelope a little bit to make it a little harsher, to bring out a little bit more of a sawtooth wave or a little bit more of a square wave. And he would do a lot of these kinds of adjustments, reverb, panning things from left to right, all that kind of stuff, and really orchestrate in electronic music, literally orchestrate, not just sit there with a bunch of mono keyboards and a microphone and just record stuff playing it live. He would write this stuff down. He did an album called Curved Air. It was something that Townsend heard and listened to and became enamored with. This is Curved Air, and it's 18 minutes long, so I don't think that anyone has the patience to listen to the entire 18 minutes today, but it is really cool. We'll play part of that today, and you'll hear what Townsend used as his beginning for Baba O'Reilly. And I've already mentioned Mayor Baba being the spiritual advisor, so there's the Baba. And O'Reilly is his homage to Terry Riley. So it's a melding of his spiritual and his physical being, I guess, in this song. It's a very cool idea.
Chuck Vasconian is the head of Rockmon Record Club. He's the guy that'll be standing up front when you go to see him at the Linda. Terry Riley, part of the Baba O'Reilly, the song that would become Baba O'Reilly,
yes,
essentially.
From the idea that the germ of the idea.
The start.
Yeah. We live in this age where we think, oh, well, they just programmed it to play that. No, that was played live. Townsend played that live in a studio with an organ, and he had a synthesizer, the EMS VCS3, which was used by everyone. He used it like a guitar pedal. He plugged the organ and made the organ the tone generator that went through the synthesizer. And then he played it in real time. First of all, I find that very cool. Second of all, what I find even cooler is when they went into the studio, they couldn't reproduce it. They couldn't make it sound the same. What you hear on the record is what he recorded in his home studio as a demo. That's pretty cool.
That is cool.
And that's a pretty hefty attention to detail, because I think a lot of people, when they record a demo, at least the people I've been associated with, when they record a demo, it's sort of like,
close enough.
Yeah, it's close enough. It's just we're just trying to get the idea out. And that's not what Townsend was doing.
Right.
Townsend was trying to play it as perfectly as he possibly could.
Well, does that go back, though, to the whole Lifehouse project where he was obsessing over everything?
Obsessing over everything.
Yeah,
yes,
yeah.
Absolutely.
Chuck, this is fascinating. So Chuck's Rockmon Record Club has a listening party for Who's Next at the Linda on December 27th.
Yes, and the doors open at 6:30, and the show starts at 7:30. I try to keep it to 2 hours, but we'll definitely get out by 10.
All right.
Yeah.
Is there anything else you'd like to touch on for the record? And we're going to have to play Baba O'Reilly.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, the last thing I'd like to touch on is the guy that plays the fiddle part, the violinist, is Dave Arbus, who is in a prog rock band called East of Eden. And Dave Arbus also is still alive and also still has a career. And he really should have been a bigger player, I think. He should have been known more, I guess, in the world. His real hit of fame with East of Eden, they had one or two radio songs in the UK, nothing really in America, even though they did tour America. But they were a prog rock band in the way that you and I would consider Jethro Tull a prog rock band. They did innovative stuff. They played different instruments. They did some things in a longer form. But Dave Arbus is a multi-instrumentalist, a very prolific writer. They had a bunch of albums, nine albums in that they released over 9 years, an album a year. Again, primarily known in Europe and the UK. Chose him to play the violin part. And what I think is so cool about the violin part at the end is that Entwistle is one of those bass players that musicians always jokingly say about The Who, that Entwistle was a better guitar player than Townsend was. Could do anything on the bass guitar. Amazing. He makes space. If you listen to it, you can hear him change what he's doing to make space for the violin. And as soon as he stops really driving the song and playing 30-second notes throughout in the background, so does Moon. Moon changes, and they lock together and make this space where Arbus can just go nuts on the violin, and he does. As they're doing that, they're getting faster and faster and faster and faster and faster. It's a tour de force, and it's all because, for me, what I hear is Entwistle says, we're going to let him take it. He's the star right now. Let him take the center stage, which is an amazing thing to have happen in a band and to hear it happen.
Especially a band like The Who. Huge band.
And a band where, sort of like Cream, Cream was sort of like three guys soloing and somehow it was a song.
Yeah.
You know, The Who had that going on. What unified The Who, what made The Who so powerful was it wasn't led by Entwistle on the bass. And it wasn't led by Townsend on the guitar. And it certainly wasn't led by Daltrey on the vocals. It was Moon. Entwistle played with the bottom end. He played with the kick drums and the floor toms that Moon was playing. And Townsend played with the top. That's how they structured their songs. And that's how they got their rhythms. If you watch videos, Moon is watching the other guys, but not as much as they're watching him. They're paying attention to everything that he's doing because they're following him. It sort of makes sense because the way Moon plays is this giant ball of chaos that somehow is a cohesive drum part. It's just amazing.
Awesome.
Nobody else has ever played like him. I don't know that anybody else would bother. A lot of times in the Rockman shows, I really feel like they're a bit of a love letter to some of the players in the band. Sometimes it's a love letter to my mom. Sometimes there's albums like Sgt. Pepper where I listen to that for months of my life with my mother, talking about the differences and things that we liked and didn't like. In this, the love letter is definitely Keith Moon. He's one of those guys that I would sit down in my 13 and 14-year-old self. I would sit down with my Lafayette headphones on and the album cranked up on the stereo as loud as I could make it. And I would sit there and bang away and couldn't come close to what he was doing.
But it was fun to try.
Oh, it was fun to try. What a great drummer.
Chuck Mazganian is here with me. Chuck, thank you so much for coming by.
Oh, Chris, my pleasure. Thank you very much.
So what are we going to listen to on the way out here?
Oh, I think we've got to listen to Bob O'Reilly.
All right.
Yeah.
Again, you're at the Linda on the 27th.
Doors are at 6:30. Show starts at 7:30. We'll get out of there by 10 at the very latest, and it's going to be a great show. I guarantee that you will love this show. And if I had a desire, my desire would be that people would come to Rockman shows, whether they like the album or not, because I can guarantee, I really absolutely feel this in my bones, that when you leave, you will leave with a new appreciation of a band that you may not have thought about before. And if you sort of listen to The Who, you're going to love this record. And if you've really listened to The Who, you're going to love the presentation. I guarantee it. It's really a lot of fun. I'm not guaranteeing it as a shill because I want to fill it up because of money or any of those other things. For me, it's about having the sense of sitting in a room with 100 people, 150 people, 10 people, listening to the same piece of music and loving it. I really don't know what could be better than that. Thank you.
And let's remind folks how they can find you again online so they can check out all the things you're doing.
You can check us out on rockmon.com, rockmon.com.
Awesome. Thanks, yeah. Chuck.
Thank you very much, Chris. I appreciate it.